OAA. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless this honorable court and the United States. You may be seated.
Morning.
Yes.
I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Sholem. As a preliminary matter, I'd like to recognize that we are holding court in conjunction with the Conference of the National Organization of Veterans Advocates. I'd also like to state we recognize NOVA provides valuable services for our country's veterans, and we appreciate your dedication. We're here today in the matter of Frank Galagos. He's got a docket number of 052920. The counsel for both parties, please note your appearance for the record.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Galagos, also appearing with Ms. Glendahurl.
I'm sorry, Glendahurl?
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Your Honor. I'm James Cowan, appearing for the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, with the Constable of the Federal Law.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed? Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel, the penalty, you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
You have it. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Frank Galagos. Mr. Galagos believes he is entitled to retroactive benefit of the amendment to 38 CFR 3.304F3 under this court's rule in Karnes. In 1991, this court created a rule of law in the case of Karnes versus Derwinski, which required the VA to apply retroactively the benefit of a veteran any change in law which was favorable to the veteran. This particular change in law was particularly favorable to this veteran, and without the benefit of that change in law, his decision was adversely decided by the board in this matter. Mr. Galagos was not represented by counsel below, but was in fact represented by a national service organization. It is Mr. Galagos's view that had he been represented by counsel, and had he been given the intended benefit of the amendment to 3.304F3, specifically, which is that no adverse decision would be made until he had an opportunity to submit specific information and evidence to corroborate.
Mr. Carpenter, does the Secretary dispute that 3.304 applies?
No, they do not. They do not dispute that it applies to Mr. Galagos' case. They do dispute that he is entitled to the benefit of a remand under rule in Karnes for the retroactive application of that, as this court has decided in the Bradford case, that a appellant is entitled to when the VA makes a decision before this notice is provided. Now, what makes this case factually distinguishable from Bradford is that this case commenced before, and the VA made its decision before, there was the first adverse decision by the VA.
Was there a board remand for it to be considered?
There was a board remand, yes, Your Honor, and the board remand did cite to it. The disconnect here is that Mr. Galagos, in our view, was not a claim as required by the regulation and by Bradford, what the meaning of that regulation would be specifically.
But didn't his representative specifically discuss it at a board at a hearing?
The board, his primary representative did, Your Honor, that's correct. And it's clear in our view from that discussion that he did not, that representative did not understand what it was that was necessary, as quite frankly is evidenced by the submission that was made. The fact is that the notice that needs to be provided has to be meaningful, and in this case it was provided to an unrepresented veteran, although the veteran was represented by a national service organization.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the notice, if I may inquire.
Yes.
What do you perceive is the timing requirement, let's say in a new case, under 3304F, as opposed to Mr. Gallegos' case where it was already pending?
Well, I think the only reaction to that can be it has to be reasonable at the time, because there is no specification in either the regulation or in this court's decision in Bradford what that length of time should be. But clearly, the veteran has to be afforded a reasonable opportunity to develop.
At what point does VA, in the process, provide that notice? Prior to a decision, clearly, under the regulation, right?
That would be correct. Okay. And you're talking in this factual situation or in the factual situation where the regulation was already in play?
I was starting with a new claim.
With a new claim,
Okay, so sometime prior to a decision being made, which is a condition as iterated in the regulation itself.
Right.
Now, in Mr. Gallegos' case, that was impossible since he already had had a final, or not a final, but a denial prior to the regulation even being enacted. So in a case such as Mr. Gallegos, when do you think the timing requires the notification to be given to him?
Well, I think the only thing that's clear under Bradford is that it has to be before the adverse decision. Now, clearly, in order for the notice to have effect and have meaning and allow him to meaningfully participate, it has to be given with enough opportunity for the veteran to effectively participate.
So perhaps analogous to the Mayfield Federal Circuit, it's sent back, you have an opportunity for a notice and another adjudication. Did that would satisfy?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would suggest that maybe under the parameters of 5103 small b would suggest that they would have to 1 year to provide such information after notice under the VCA was provided. I understand that this is not VCA notification. We're talking about separate notification, a specialized notification, if you will, an enhanced notification requirement. And if the general notice requirement is up to 1 year, it would seem to me that up to 1 year is a reasonable time frame for the veteran to be provided and to understand that he has that much time in order to do it. Now, part of the problem and the disconnect here in the government's position is that neither Mr. Gallegos nor his attorney, or excuse me, his representative, non-attorney representative, understood what it was that was required under this regulation, because it was not explained. It was reproduced in the SOC, and it was reproduced in substance in the board remand.
But in terms of... Mr. Learman, who's his representative, what did he not understand? Now, I'm looking at the record 843. He reiterates 3.304F3 at his board hearing and the board remanded. What is it that you say that he somehow did not understand?
Well, I believe that it's the use of the example. If you go to the text of 3.304F, the VA's own regulation provides specific examples of behavior changes which may constitute credible evidence of a stressor. Now, in my view, Your Honor, this is a fairly sophisticated proposition to expect a non-attorney representative or an unrepresented veteran to understand in terms of how to evidentially establish that there were specific behavioral changes that would constitute credible supporting evidence that an incident occurred. No, I do not believe it was, Your Honor. I believe what was transmitted was simply the text, not the context.
Examples of such evidence include, but are not limited to, reports from law enforcement authorities, rape crisis centers, mental health counseling centers.
But the question from Judge Castle was, what was it that either Mr. Gallegos or his representative did not understand about that? And I was trying to explain that what I believe they did not understand was how you use those behavioral changes to demonstrate the event having actually occurred, and what then would make that credible supporting evidence.
You're suggesting to us that notice that was provided in the statement of the case, which is acknowledged and referenced at a board hearing thereafter by a representative, where he specifically states evidence of behavior change following the claim to solve is one type of relevant evidence that may be found in these sources. Examples of behavior changes that may constitute credible evidence of stressor include, but are not limited to, requests for transfer to another military duty, et cetera, on page 843 of the record. But somehow or another, you must look at this and say he didn't understand that.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying first that Mr. Galeos is entitled to the retroactive benefit of this regulation. And this regulation has been interpreted by this court to require that no adverse decision is made before that information.
But he got in the statement of the case. He had a hearing. He discussed it. The board remanded it, and there's another statement of the case thereafter. What would you have them do?
To explain to the veteran that they would not make another adverse decision.
In the record before the board hearing, what is it you would explain? It's already been stated
in those very words, Your Honor, that we are not going to make. Now, all they did was to repeat verbatim what is in the regulation. And they presumed that both the veteran and the veteran's non-attorney representative understood what that meant.
So if you received the letter, and it repeated the examples that are in the regulation, you would say that's insufficient notice?
I'm saying to provide that to, in this circumstance, an unrepresented veteran, in this context, during the pendency of the appeal. Under the Karnas Doctrine, when there's a change in law, the veteran is entitled to have that change in law.
We accept that Karnas still applies. Just accept that the Secretary is not arguing against the application. I'm still confused as to why that notice was, one, not provided, two, not understood, three, not remanded, and four, another decision provided. How, in what shape and form, does that not comply, even with not having provided in the first instance, which was as pointed out here, could not have been done because the regulation came into effect after?
Because it is a matter of whether or not this was or was not a meaningful opportunity to participate. There was no indication in any of these notices, whether it's in the SOC or in the BVA remand, that something had happened that was different. They didn't say to the veteran or the veteran's representative that now we have...
Did they submit additional information on the remand?
They did submit additional information, and frankly, that submission, I think, is a demonstration.
So are you arguing the ineffective representation below? Is that really your issue?
No, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is that this court's case law under Karnas provides Mr. Galeos another bite of the apple. This court decided in 1991 that in this non-adversarial system, that when there was a change in law during the pendency of an action, that a special benefit would be afforded to that veteran.
But how was it not afforded here? That's what I'm not understanding.
Or more clearly, what would be adequate if we agreed with you that it had to go back? What would a good notice look like in your opinion?
Well, I think...
Or is that what you're advocating, that he should get more notice?
Well, clearly I believe he should get more notice and should get the type of notice that was described in Bradford that specifically focuses on the fact that the veteran is now in a do-over position. Clearly, we as attorneys understand that he was in a do-over position. I do not believe that his representative or Mr. Galeos understood.
Well, wouldn't that be an effective representation? Isn't that really the heart of your argument?
Your Honor, I believe ineffective assistance of the representative goes to an adversarial system. This is not supposed to be an adversarial system, and to convert or subvert this system into an adversarial system at the administrative level is simply inapposite with the intention of Congress. The intention of Congress is that the veteran is to be aided. The VA took the affirmative action. They just frankly didn't take it far enough. They took it to the point where...
What could they have done? Biden knows. Hearing where it's discussed by the representative, which seems to pair it pretty well. They remanded for additional evidence to be provided. They allow over a year of time, if I recall correctly, for evidence to be submitted. Evidence is submitted. Another decision is made. A request to expedite a decision by the board is presented. The board renders a decision. And clearly, the regulation has been applied. What part of that process is a problem?
The part of the process is that Mr. Galeos and his representative were not put in a position where they understood that they were going to get another opportunity.
So if they had said
that they got a clean slate, that the intention, as I understand this court's decision in Bradford, is that nothing adverse is going to happen until we have given you this notice.
What does the remand on 859 say?
All the remand does on 859 is inherit the text of the regulation. It does nothing, just as the statement case before this did nothing, to explain the contextual circumstances of what this means. There is a change in law. What does that change in law mean?
Where is it effective on page 859?
By failure to explain by Mr. Galeo or his representative that a new decision would be made, because under this regulation, the VA is not going to make an adverse decision until we have given you this specific notice and given you an opportunity to submit the evidence that would demonstrate what would make it credible supporting evidence. It seems to me evident, Your Honor, that when you read the text of the SOC, that the VA did not consider that there was anything differently done when they made that SSOC. What I'm suggesting to you is that under the plain language of 7105, there is supposed to be an opportunity to resolve the matter before the issuance of a statement of the case. And given that there was a change in law, that's when the pedal should have been applied to this case.
But weren't they?
Wait, pardon?
Weren't the first pedals applied?
No, they weren't. They
so
were,
board
they
remand, were applied. Board with, remand that specifically discusses the application of the regulations, not the breaking of the case.
No, Your Honor, because at that point, they simply had put the Mr. Galeos and his representative on inadequate notice as to what the meaning was of that change in law. There is nothing to indicate that there was a meaningful change in law and now he got some additional benefit. They just said, we want more evidence from you, and if you give us this more evidence, we'll take another look at it. It's not a matter of we'll take another look at it. We will not make an adverse decision until you have had an opportunity to get that evidence.
Mr. Carpenter, by me. 4 minutes and 27 seconds, you got the pain. Let's go back to the predicate of your argument. And you're suggesting that Karnes was not explicitly overruled by Gushon, is that correct?
That's, well, it was to the statutory portion, but not as to the regulatory portion.
Okay, so you're drawing that distinction between the regulatory and the statutory.
Yes. And that the case from the Federal Circuit in Rodriguez affirms that there is retroactivity to VA regulations. And the supplemental authority that we submitted from AG is further evidence that the Federal Circuit adopts the notion that there is retroactivity to VA regulations. In the AG case, the Federal Circuit allowed the government to come into court and say that a regulation that didn't even exist was going to be allowed to be considered on remand. Now, it seems to me that that is directly in step with this court's decision in Karnes. If you look at what this court did in 1991, this court recognized the unique nature of this process. There isn't a process in any type of federal benefit program that is comparable to what happens in the adjudication of veterans' claims. And therefore, special assistance must be given. The VA came into this vis-a-vis their own their own annual provisions, which they weren't following in YR and Patton. And this court said, if you're going to have those regulations, you're going to have to follow them. And then the VA expanded those manual provisions and put them into regulations. Those regulations are extraordinarily meaningful to veterans in the development of their claim. But if there isn't fair notice to the veteran as to what the meaning of that is, then the superficiality of simply including the verbatim recitation of the change is, at least in my view, inadequate, but more importantly, inconsistent with this court's holding and this court's ruling parts. That you get a do-over. Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, I just want to finish that thought.
In your briefs, you based your distinction that Karnes still lives on whether a change is negative or positive, I'm assuming, to the veteran.
Yes.
Not on this statute versus regulation retroactivity division.
No, because frankly, I made the assumption since I was counsel in Guzman that I understood that the Federal Circuit, at my urging, had said that their decisions in Diamond and Burnclow overruled that portion only of Karnes, which spoke to retroactivity for statutes. I thought that was settled law. So no, I did not press.
Okay. Moving on to sort of the cases that have occurred since CUSMA, for example, in Rodriguez, the Federal Circuit used fairly emphatic language saying they didn't understand why our court did not utilize the Landgraf or Princess Cruz's test, and that Landgraf is the exclusive way to determine retroactivity. I have that very strong language. How do you carve out a niche based on the uniqueness of the veterans system as opposed to in Rodriguez?
Well, I guess I don't read anything in Rodriguez as adversely affecting Karnes. What survives in Karnes on the regulatory side of the equation is that when there is a change in law, that change in law is retroactively applicable. The rule that the government succeeded or prevailed in Rodriguez is that if it's negative, then we can apply it negative. And I simply suggest that the converse must naturally be true. If it's favorable, then it must likewise be applicable retroactively. And that there is nothing to